drugs,
rape, quality of life,
recovery, harm reduction,
advocacy,
policy, treatment,
stigma.
Drugs Uncut, the Scottish Drugs Forum podcast.
Hello and welcome to Drugs Uncut. We're back again and I'm here with my co-host Austin Smith. Hi Austin.
Hi.
And we've got a new co-host with us today who is Julie Heslin-McCartney and is new to Scottish Drugs Forum. So Julie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to just say what you do at SDF?
Yeah, so I am the new Director of Operations with Scottish Drugs Forum. So that involves managing all our programmes of work, from workforce development through to our addiction worker trainee programme. So yeah, it keeps me very busy on a daily basis.
Thanks, Julie. And we've convened ahead of our annual conference to mark International Overdose Awareness Day, which is actually taking place on the 31st of August, so on the day this year. We're recording this podcast ahead of the day because we are very grateful to have one of our international guests joining us for our podcast today, Dr. Ryan Marino from Cleveland, Ohio. Ryan, a very warm welcome to Glasgow.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful being in Glasgow.
Your first time here?
First time.
Yeah, and have the people been friendly to you?
The people have been lovely.
Good stuff, good stuff. So Ryan, probably be useful if you could just do a little bit of an introduction about yourself at the moment, and then we'll get into the discussion about what we want to quiz you on in terms of what's happening in Cleveland. And certainly I've been an avid follower of yours on Twitter, or whatever we're supposed to call it now, for some time. So yeah, over to you for an introduction.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm Ryan Marino. I'm a MD. And I work a few different jobs. So I'm a medical toxicologist, emergency physician, and an addiction medicine doctor. And so the intersection of those three things kind of has been drugs, substance use, and treating people who use drugs, overdoses, and the like. I've been practicing for the past 10 years in Western Pennsylvania and Northeast Ohio. And so those are two areas that were hit pretty hard and pretty early with fentanyl, and I've seen a lot of overdoses. So that has kind of really shaped the work that I do, and has driven me to, as you mentioned, social media, where I try to do some advocacy because of all the senselessness that has been going on.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. So loads that we definitely want to have a conversation with you about ahead of you presenting to our delegates tomorrow at the conference. Also realised while you were saying that, I didn't bother saying who I was. My name's Kirsten Horsford, I'm CEO at Scottish Drugs Forum. I'm probably, can't remember if I was in that post when we recorded our last podcast, but just for those who are first-time listeners, that's who I am, my dulcet tones. I'm going to pass over to Austin. You've got some introductory pointers that we're going to go through with Ryan. I'm really looking forward to hearing about your work.
Yeah, well, the question's about the work, I suppose. You know, what is it you're seeing in terms of drugs, in terms of working in an emergency department? What is it you encounter?
So, I mean, the main thing that I see in the emergency department has been overdoses, and overdoses are kind of the theme of what has been going on in the States for quite a while now, primarily driven by fentanyl. So fentanyl, I mean, showed up in the drug supply when heroin disappeared, and that was the U.S. was very successful in eliminating the opium and heroin supply that was making it into the United States, primarily from northern Mexico. And so fentanyl showed up. It was not something that was desired. We saw different analogs of fentanyl showed up for a while. I mean, things people have probably heard about, like carfentanil, driving overdoses. And so, I mean, I remember for a while there was a time when I would see the same patient two, sometimes even three times during a 10-hour shift, where they were coming in with multiple overdoses just because of how unpredictable the drug supply has been. More recently, I would say that I am primarily seeing kind of secondary harms, people with bad infections, people with wounds, and we're now seeing kind of other newer, scarier, I would say, more unpredictable things showing up as well. Xylazine would be like the most recent one that's causing a lot of difficulties with treatment, difficulties with withdrawal, and then kind of very strange and difficult to treat wounds as well.
Okay, so what you're seeing in a sense is we haven't seen any of this, or maybe it's more accurate to say we haven't seen any of this yet. So I suppose what is the key contrast compared with heroin overdoses, which you must have been dealing with 10 years ago? So in an A&E department, typically in the UK at the moment, you're primarily, if it's opiates, opioids, it's heroin that you're dealing with. So what are the differences in terms of the level of need and just how busy you are?
Yeah, well, when fentanyl and the other synthetic opioids first showed up in heroin, the biggest problem was overdoses. People didn't know what they were getting. You could be going to your same heroin dealer from one day to the next, taking the exact same amount, the exact same way that you used it, and getting something completely different, something that you didn't want, that you weren't expecting. And so that was why we were seeing not only just the patients I had referenced coming back multiple times during my shift because they were getting new and unexpected drugs and overdosing, but people having much more severe overdoses requiring kind of long-term hospitalizations and having pretty profound effects from that if they weren't dying. And we saw astronomical increases over a period of years where we went from a few thousand overdose deaths per year with heroin. And heroin and kind of opioid use rates didn't really change over any of this period that dramatically. But those few thousand a year went to now we have consistently over 100,000 overdose deaths a year in the United States. And so I would say that's probably been the biggest change, is that overdoses are just have become, I hate to say this, but they've become like a way of life over there. And it's almost like people have accepted and normalized them. And so they change really everything that I do in terms of, I mean, treatment of withdrawal, treatment of kind of like long-term opioid use disorder. All of that has changed in the age of fentanyl, because fentanyl, it just behaves differently. It's completely different. And now that's all changing again. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the effects have been kind of very wide-reaching. But in just a matter of years, seeing really dramatic consequences of this and making the work even more difficult. And it seems to kind of be snowballing to this day.
Okay. And in those early days, I mean, I suppose historically, harm reduction approaches actually evolved from the behavior of people who were using drugs themselves. So they learn to use things in a safer way, and then teach others. And so, was there any harm reduction that evolved from people who were exposed to risk themselves in those early days of transition to fentanyls? And I suppose my secondary question around that is there a reaction from users? Is there a higher demand for treatment? Do people try and get into treatment more readily because of the dangers and the risks out there?
So, yeah, I mean, I think in terms of harm reduction, when fentanyl first started showing up, this was not something that people were seeking out, did not desire. And I think, I mean, this is a very long and separate tangent that we could have a very long discussion about. But fentanyl probably was inevitable. I mean, it's a easy to make, potent synthetic opioid. People have adjusted to it as kind of the primary drug in the drug supply. And so that may have happened regardless, but when this first started showing up, people were not expecting it. They were not expecting the potency. And because it is 50 times more potent than heroin, a difference in drug of a small percentage could make a double dose, a triple dose that you were getting. And so in terms of black market drugs, you don't have kind of access to the same regulation, purity standards, and that kind of thing. And so, I mean, 1%, 2% difference in purity is very easy to make that mistake. And that was really how I first learned about harm reduction, was talking to my patients and how they were scared to use these drugs, how they no longer felt safe using alone, how they would use differently now, using smaller amounts, going slower, that kind of thing, and switching over from injection to snorting or smoking and those kind of things. And so I guess in one way that has helped kind of bring harm reduction more to the forefront. Although I can't say that harm reduction has been accepted or embraced in any meaningful way. But yeah, I think fentanyl definitely changed things because of how scary it was and how, I mean, people were just dropping dead.
Can I just ask, Ryan, in terms of naloxone distribution as a sort of take, we would describe it as take-home naloxone over here. Is naloxone distributed to people who are at risk of overdose so that they can use it on their peers should an overdose occur in emergency?
Yes. So naloxone is one thing that I think has been pretty well embraced. There is still a lot of stigma and misinformation about that, and a lot of other kind of limitations that are, in my opinion, completely unnecessary to this day on distribution of naloxone. But for the most part, people have accepted naloxone. And so take-home naloxone programs, I mean, are pretty widespread. Obviously, there still could be a lot more done. I mean, 100,000 overdoses, every single one could be reversed with naloxone. So that tells you that there's not enough out there. But that is, I think, one benefit of kind of harm reduction. And I have to say that people who use drugs, I mean, they perform most of the reversals. They're the ones who use, request, access naloxone. And so that is kind of the work that has happened because of fentanyl, sadly, but also hopefully for the better in the long run.
Yeah, and just on the question of treatment that Austin was asking about, has there been any discussions around safe supply approaches that have been started to be introduced in other countries around the actual prescribing of fentanyl to people who use them?
So there have been conversations, but that's really all there has been at this point. I don't think this is something that the political climate or public officials in the United States really take seriously, which is unfortunate because fentanyl is a great example of why safe supply could make a difference. And seeing, I mean, other potent synthetic opioids, other drugs like xylazine, I mean, the nitazines, these other things showing up, they not only increase overdoses, make it more difficult to treat overdoses, cause more overdoses, cause more deaths. But in terms of long-term treatment, it's much more difficult. I mean, back in the days when people were using heroin and I was seeing them in the hospital for withdrawal, it was very easy to start someone on buprenorphine, methadone, whatever. We had a protocol. It worked almost every time without really much thought. And now, I mean, people have these kind of prolonged withdrawal from fentanyl, probably because fentanyl is very lipophilic. It distributes to all the tissues in your body. And so people can get precipitated withdrawal starting buprenorphine even more than 24 hours after their last use. All these kind of things that have just thrown a wrench into everything. And yeah, I think without the discussion of safe supply, you're not really having kind of meaningful discussions about addressing this at this point. And so our policy remains focused on kind of criminalizing fentanyl. Now we're trying to criminalize xylazine, but it just keeps pushing towards new things that are going to show up without addressing the actual problem and without learning from the mistakes that have been made over and over.
Okay. Well, talking of learning from mistakes, we have very little, if any, fentanyl in the supply, and where it is, it's a contaminant, if you like. But we do have recently reported and started testing for the presence of nitazines. So this is a proper heroin supply that has some nitazine in it. And there have been harms caused by that, including fatal overdoses. But I suppose my question is, if we're at that stage, what is it we should be doing to prepare? It's been hard to convince or to strike a balance between having a panic that, you know, something's imminent and some radical change, but also having a realistic preparation. And I suppose part of the driver for more recent concern has been the Taliban's ban on poppy cultivation, which may not impact on heroin supply in Scotland and in Europe more broadly. But may, and may 100%. So it's a kind of all or nothing situation we're in. So anyway, what would your advice be?
Yeah, and I think the Taliban ban is definitely something that should raise alarm bells. I don't know enough about kind of drug supply economics to know how that will definitely play out. But that is exactly what we saw in the States, was the natural opium and heroin supply was cut off, and without addressing kind of the demand for drugs, the people who use drugs on the other end, this kind of supply side disruption led to the rise of synthetics. And synthetics, anyone can make. You really don't need that much skill or training. You can buy precursors very easily on the internet. You can make them in a plastic bucket in your own home. But so this is something that I think is kind of inevitable with that ban. And so whether that's 12 months, 24 months down the road, it is likely that more and more synthetics will show up, whatever they are, nitazenes, fentanyl, anything else. And the nitazenes, I think, are very comparable to fentanyl. And it is hard, to your point about kind of balancing between fear-mongering, making people scared that this is something that's coming and that everyone should be worried about, but also having kind of a pragmatic approach that people, once this shows up, people will still use this. This is probably something that some people may even be seeking out. That may be why more potent drugs are showing up already. We've had some of the nitazenes in the States, and seeing the response from public officials has been, I mean, calling them things like zombie opioids, calling them naloxone resistant, which is not true, saying that they're new, super potent, more potent drugs. And the interesting thing about nitazenes, which very similar to a lot of the fentanyl analogs, is they were originally developed as pharmaceutical drugs back in the 50s and 60s, and so have pretty good historical data to go with them. They've been tested in animals and humans. We kind of know at least a little bit about how they work. And for the most part, they're not more potent than fentanyl. They should respond to naloxone just the same. And so these things, I mean, are all very reassuring. So yes, it is concerning that synthetic opioids and more potent opioids will likely be showing up and kind of replacing the drugs in the supply. And people should be aware of that. And that should be kind of a cause for discussions about a safe supply and legalization and regulation. But at the same time, we can't all be terrified. There are ways to address this, having naloxone available, having things like overdose prevention centers or supervised consumption centers are definitely all kind of pragmatic responses. This isn't something that you have to worry about needing 20 doses of Narcan. Going near someone is going to be a risk, and anything like that.
And that, I guess, brings me to my thoughts around when I first came across you online, was because we've known about the issue in the States and Canada and other areas in terms of the fentanyl issue. And I guess it's always been raised as a potential issue for Scotland. But one of the things that I was really interested in was around the misinformation. Our conference tomorrow is all based around the international theme for Overdose Awareness Day, which is about hearing from people who are often marginalised or their voices are often not heard. But the theme that we've asked you to speak around on your talk is what happens when the voices of people sharing that misinformation or disinformation is amplified, particularly through the media. So I'm just really interested to hear, you've obviously been, a controversial voice sometimes on a platform? A no-nonsense response or approach, maybe. And it was your What the Fentanyl stuff that caught my attention several years ago. And I'd certainly shared it around a number of people, the stuff that you'd put together from that, just to try and dispel some of those myths before they started getting some roots in Scotland as well. But just really interested to hear your perspective about particularly the policing response in the States around fentanyl.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up because it has been controversial, unfortunately. And I mean, I've dedicated like most of my career to trying to stop overdoses, to treat people with substance use, and trying to kind of reduce the harms of drugs. And I feel like most of my advocacy work has actually been having to kind of defend fentanyl and tell people that fentanyl is not the kind of boogeyman or like sinister thing that they make it out to be. And we've seen so much misinformation about fentanyl in the American media over the past decade that I would describe it as kind of like a boogeyman. Fentanyl is something that I use medically every day. I mean, it is one of the most invaluable therapeutic medicines around the world. It's probably one of the most ubiquitously used things in terms of, I mean, treatment of pain, but also sedation. And with, I mean, kind of the recent COVID pandemic, fentanyl was very valuable in all the patients who were on ventilators. We had shortages actually of it in the United States, which I think was very detrimental. But I will now have patients turn down fentanyl when they come in with horrible injuries, broken bones sticking out of their skin, that kind of thing, just because of what they've heard. And so I never really pictured that I would be the one going out there and saying fentanyl is not that bad, or doing this work to defend it. But for whatever reason, there seems to be a story every week now. Last week there were two. There was one just yesterday with a double story, I guess. So I don't know if they're increasing in frequency, but they're not going away at all, where people believe that you can overdose just by touching something that has fentanyl in it, that people are having these overdoses, and that the drugs on the street are now a harm to first responders and to the general public. And this is particularly an issue in the field of law enforcement. It seems is the only place where this continues to be perpetuated. But these stories seem to go viral. They'll release very dramatic footage of someone experiencing what they call an overdose. And the problem is this is not possible, first of all. I mean, that is the problem. So misinformation is bad. That's a truism. False things are false. But people believe this, and they seem to be kind of a like self-perpetuating cycle here, where if you believe so strongly that coming into contact with something that has fentanyl on it or that is fentanyl, that it's going to harm you, that naturally you're going to have some sort of dramatic reaction when that actually happens to you. And so I watch these videos, and as someone who treats fentanyl overdoses can sit and say that this is obviously not a fentanyl overdose. The symptoms that the people have is usually the exact opposite. They'll report like fear, panic, racing heart, shallow, rapid breathing. And all of those things are the exact opposite of what opioids do. And I remember when these first started happening, I mean, I thought it was kind of funny because it's so untrue. It's impossible. This is the opposite of that. But the reason that I am so motivated to stop this and why I think this is so bad is I've seen people who are having a real overdose, someone who was shooting drugs or snorting drugs and is overdosing on fentanyl and actively dying, be refused treatment that they need because people are too scared to go near them because they think that they can overdose just from this exposure. And so that was something that made me stop laughing about these stories and got me motivated to do something about it. But in the years since then, I've now seen this, I mean, become kind of weaponized in our legal system to not only add criminal charges to people who are found with something as silly as just like possession of drugs, but this has been actually put into law in several U.S. states. Our Department of Homeland Security has considered classifying fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, even though it's a valuable medicine and it is not a weapon. If it could be weaponized, the United States would have figured out a way to do that, I can assure you. But yeah, I mean, people are literally spending time in prison cells because of something that's scientifically impossible, and people are dying from overdoses because people believe in something that's impossible. And so not only are people having what I can only assume is something like a panic attack, which is bad enough in itself, but the other harms, I mean, are kind of immeasurable at this point. And so I hope in this age where synthetic opioids are here to stay, they're going to end up everywhere at some point. I just hope that the misinformation that goes along with them does not go along with them. And I could speculate kind of about where this came from, why it's so pervasive. The U.S. has a long history of drug misinformation. But yeah, it is bad.
Yeah, I think that's, from an outsider's perspective, the biggest concern about the delay in care to the person who is actually potentially having a near-death experience, because they have genuinely overdosed on fentanyl, and that just sort of resistance to then step in and help quickly because of fears that have been spread.
So beyond that even, I mean, and people will ask me all the time, like, what's the problem if everyone's more scared of fentanyl, if you're just scared of it, even though it's not true. And so, I mean, there are those real harms, like not resuscitating someone who's dying of an overdose. But it also, I mean, distracts from conversations about the fact that we have 109,000 people died from completely preventable overdoses last year. It takes funding away from meaningful measures. And I mean, diverts like political and policy discussions towards things like additional criminalization for fentanyl, which is already criminalized and illegal, but adding like additional charges for that rather than trying to improve access to things like treatment, to harm reduction things. And I mean, particularly the funding is a problem in itself, because people will go to the lengths of having hazmat gear to go to overdose scenes. There was recently a coroner, I think in Louisiana, called a hazmat team in because the patient they were working on had died of a fentanyl overdose. And a hazmat cleanup, I mean, usually costs somewhere around $50,000 US, just kind of at minimum. Hazmat gear for kind of law enforcement to go into a scene is probably like $1,000 a person. There's special fentanyl-proof gloves. All of this stuff has kind of, it's created its own scam economy. And that diverts... We have a lot of settlement money from cases against the manufacturers like Purdue and the Sacklers, and that money being diverted into, I mean, totally unnecessary things while people are dying, when we could be spending this on take-home naloxone, that kind of thing. It's just really problematic.
And there's been a bit of a push here as well in terms of the conversation around... We talked about some of the strategies, and these are all things that we would be pushing for as well, like safer consumption facilities, drug checking services, better access to treatment. Is there in the States a big drive towards abstinence-focused services and residential rehab settings and that side of things? And is that problematic? Is it helpful? What's your feeling around that?
Yes. The treatment industry is... problematic for a number of reasons, but the prevailing belief in what recovery and treatment is still primarily based on abstinence, or the idea of detoxification, or maybe short-term withdrawal treatment, kind of in like the best case scenario. But medications and medical treatment are still heavily stigmatized, and significantly limited. And beyond that, like harm reduction and kind of allowing people to continue to use drugs in a safer way is essentially unheard of.
It's not entirely a foreign culture. I should say to you, Ryan, as a visitor to the country, there is that European thing where people sort of laugh at Americans. So the temptation is to hope that people laugh at some of that stuff around fentanyls and the myths that you've been challenging. Of course, we have that here. So we in particularly in a Scottish context, in prisons, we've had similar kind of incidents, several of them reported, of staff who, you know, have been searching a cell and come across a substance, and it's usually around novel psychoactive substances, stimulants usually. My point is that There's a humanity to that. It's not simply cultural or something that happens in America or with American policing and not police here. So you're right to identify that myth busting as part of something we should be looking at here.
And I think that, I mean, at the end of the day, people are really terrified of drugs in kind of all Western societies, it seems like. And it's not just opioids, it's not just fentanyl. People have this irrational fear of people who use drugs and the drugs that they're using. If that's something that we can work on, I mean, there's very few drugs you have to worry about touching. There's very few drugs that we don't understand in any way. I think that is really important. And so that is what keeps me going a lot of the time, even though people think that I'm defending fentanyl, promoting drug use, whatever they want to say. I think it goes back to kind of, there's a lot of puritanical roots tying our cultures together, a lot of belief in abstinence only kind of treatments, those things as well.
Julia, just in terms of your experience, obviously your previous roles with the Scottish Ambulance Service, I just wondered, while all these conversations have been happening, did you ever get a sense in the ambulance service about that sort of anxiety or sort of, thinking ahead to synthetics and fentanyl and stuff? Was there ever anything that really cropped up in terms of those discussions?
Not that I can recall. I don't think we had too many discussions about what might be coming in the future. It was probably more about how do we get prepared for now. So from a Scottish Ambulance perspective, just to let you know, Ryan, my previous job was drug harm reduction lead with our ambulance service here. And we worked quite hard to ensure all the ambulance crew were trained to give out naloxone to members of the public on the scene of an emergency where they had attended to treat a patient. And I think very much it was about ensuring that the information and the education of our ambulance crews is as robust as it could be. And I think we expect a certain amount of that from our kind of medical professionals from a pre-hospital setting. But actually what we found was there was probably really big gaps in their knowledge and understanding of street drugs, street trends, and how to give proper advice to patients and real clinical advice to patients that would be useful for their onward transition, whether it was to hospital or in fact indeed they stayed in the community. So it was a really interesting time. And I guess it led us on to talk a lot about what else our emergency services can do from a harm reduction perspective. And I was thinking as you were talking there earlier on about, I guess, preparedness for change, like how do we get prepared for the change that's potentially going to come our way in terms of synthetic opioids. And we discussed a lot about wounds and other kind of health-related harms. And I was really curious to ask from a kind of comparative basis, do you see much difference in terms of the level of wounds, infections, and all that kind of thing when it comes to heroin compared to synthetic opioids? Would you say there was a drastic difference in those types of complications or harms from synthetics to kind of heroin, or would you say they're much the same?
I think for the most part, they've been similar. We still have a tremendous problem in terms of preventable infections like endocarditis, and I mean skin and soft tissue infections, all of these things that could be solved with a few cents worth of clean supplies, which is really unfortunate because, I mean, an admission to the hospital for an infected heart valve and then valve replacement surgery can run hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, or can be life-ending for somebody. But in terms of wounds, the one thing we've seen, and I've been fortunate, my region has not been particularly hard hit as of yet, but xylazine, which I've mentioned a few times, has been showing up. And just to give a little background on that, because it is kind of like a new thing, and I don't think it's in a lot of places, it's not an opioid. It's only used in veterinary medicine, but it's most similar to kind of things that we use for blood pressure or sedation. And so it doesn't respond to naloxone in an overdose, and it creates a withdrawal that won't respond to typical medications. But the weirdest thing about it, or the worst thing about it, I guess I should say, is that it's been associated with these horrible wounds, and they're not even at injection site. They can be kind of distant to that, and they've been very difficult to treat. And so for people who are experiencing miserable withdrawals that are no longer responding to typical medications, even in the best case scenario where they're getting access to medications, this is keeping people away from the healthcare system. And so these wounds are not getting the treatment that they need. And so we're seeing worse outcomes from that for sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to pick up on that preparedness point, because this has been something that we've talked about in Scotland. I mean, Scotland's been described as having a public health emergency in terms of our rates of drug-related deaths, certainly the highest rates across the whole of Europe. We've got a population of about 5.4 million people, and we've just had our National Records of Scotland report on the numbers of drug deaths from 2022, and 1,051 people lost their lives that year from a preventable overdose. So there's been much discussion around preparedness for synthetic opioids, but all the things that we should be doing for an emergence of synthetic opioids are all things that we should be doing just now, because we're not even managing the current emergency situation that we have. So sadly, if we were to see a large emergence of synthetics, we would know about it immediately from a lot of the things that you've described in terms of amount of overdoses, the amount of presentations at hospitals. So, I mean, the question is, why are we not doing those things? I'm not asking you directly, why is Scotland not doing this? But in the States as well, you know, what is the resistance? What do you think is at the core issue of really providing evidence-based, common sense approaches to these crises that are happening across the world?
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels there. I mean, the kind of record-breaking deaths being described as leveling off or plateauing almost sounds like normalization of record-breaking preventable deaths. And it feels to me, at least in the States, like this is something that people are just, I don't know if they're numb to it or just willing to accept at this point. I mean, more than 100,000 deaths a year. And I guess COVID maybe should have taught me that people were willing to accept a lot of preventable deaths over there. But I don't know why people are so resistant. It seems like these discussions you can have over and over again. You can give people all the evidence in the world. And if they have a preconceived notion, a deep-seated belief, and I think these kind of are societal, like deep-rooted societal beliefs, that drugs are bad. You have to kind of stop using drugs on your own. This is a moral failing, those kind of things. It's really hard to overcome until someone is personally affected by it. And that's a really bad way to kind of go about public health for one thing, but also really traumatizing to a lot of people. And so, I mean, most people I know have lost someone to an overdose at this point, if not more than one. It's really, really disheartening to kind of see people suffering needlessly in the hospital over and over again. But unless I can force someone to see that with their own eyes and kind of show someone that this person, I mean, died alone after receiving $1 million of medical care for something that could have been prevented with a syringe exchange program, it doesn't seem like anyone is willing to listen. And I think politics goes a long way with that, because it's very easy to take a tough on drugs approach. It's very easy to say that you're doing something when you kind of do something short-sighted, like criminalization, increasing policing, law enforcement response, that kind of thing. And that maybe looks good, but in the long run is a detriment to society. And we've seen the harms in both of our countries.
Yeah. And I think some of the coverage, you know, kind of conservative perspective, you know, about it talks about lifestyle choices and your freedom to choose to use drugs or not, is made worse in this specific scenario where people like my organisation, my role within that, you're trying to get facts across. So one of the facts you sort of trot out is that some substance is 50 times the strength of another or whatever. And so people think that people are choosing to use a substance that's got 50 times the effect of something that, you know, is already causing them issues. So it might be useful to explain what we really mean by 50 times as strong and what people are actually buying. So the substance that, you know, causes them to overdose is that much stronger, but the way it's supplied to people is actually the problem. So it's a kind of admixture of dilutants and the substance itself, and the difficulty that dealers have in actually having a supply that's consistent in terms of strength?
Yeah. So in terms of that number specifically, in comparing kind of heroin and fentanyl and when they switched over, so most people use heroin in, it comes as like a dry powder in little bags. And for injection use, there is black tar heroin, and certainly other opioids come in other forms. But that is the majority, and where I've been, that's the majority, and I believe around here it is as well, of the way that people use. And historically, in the United States at least, that would be about 50% pure. And so everyone's heard of kind of like cutting agents, filler, that kind of thing. And so you used to get about 50% heroin in your little bag, and whatever dose that would be. And so you would know how many bags you would use. But say it was 51% one day, 49%, even if it was say like 55%, something like that, that doesn't really make a big difference on kind of the end result or the dose that gets delivered. But when fentanyl first showed up, and this essentially just replaced heroin overnight, there was not much heroin. Within a very short period of time, heroin, I would say, all but disappeared from the street drug supply. And so this was being put into the same kind of powder mixture at 1%. And so as small as 1% difference would be double the dose of what you were getting. And when you're talking about kind of black market, this is people, I mean, measuring things out on a kitchen scale or something in their home. A 1% of a small couple grams of powder is really hard to get right, get that down to the exact details there. And so I think that was the biggest problem. We've now seen fentanyl. One of the other issues with it is that because it's the way it behaves, the pharmacologic properties it has, now things, the street supply is 6%, 10%. People need more and more of this, just because that's the way fentanyl works, which is, again, another problem with having fentanyl as your only drug available, really, and should, I think, be a good argument for a safe supply, but I think gives rise to this notion that people just want more drugs. People are seeking out more potent drugs. And sure, there's someone out there who maybe is, but that's not the trend. That's not typical. That's not what happens for the majority of people. And again, is just kind of like a misinformation that everyone seems to somehow believe that people all seem, I don't know at what point kind of in like your education or growing up, everyone learned the same myths about drugs. But it seems like everyone did at some point. Yeah. So yeah, that's another one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it starts with that kind of Nancy Reagan, just say no. So, I mean, I think a lot of what people see is that people who use drugs just said yes, and you know, and they made the wrong choice, and they have to live with the consequences of that choice.
Yeah. For most people, when you think of someone who is injecting heroin, the thing that comes to mind, I mean, is probably some like Hollywood stereotype, like someone who's at rock bottom, lives under a bridge, whatever. We all have these ideas in our head, and I don't know why that is the prevailing concept or where this came from, that is acceptable as the norm. But at least in the United States, again, my statistics may not be totally applicable, but I think they're probably pretty generalizable here as well. 1 in 3 people uses illicit drugs every month. And so that, I mean, is a very hotly contested and controversial number, and probably includes things like cannabis, which is still illegal in most of the United States. But the number of people who use opioids or who even just meet criteria for opioid use disorder is a significant percentage of our population. It might be like 1 in 20 people are using fentanyl, probably, or heroin or pills that they're buying on the street, something like that. And so these are people who come from all walks of life, are in every profession. If you know 20 people, you probably know someone who is using heroin, fentanyl, that kind of thing. And so I just hope that it doesn't take having a loved one, a friend, a coworker, whatever, die before people realize that, and that those people kind of deserve compassion deserve the same evidence-based care that we would provide for any other condition or any other situation. You go to a bar, that's a supervised consumption center. You aren't drinking alone. You have someone there who can cut you off, who can make sure that the bad things don't happen to you, hopefully. I mean, not to say that that's perfect, but you get a safe supply of pure ethanol. You don't have to worry about what's coming in it. And we do the same thing. Most of adult medicine, I mean, is really harm reduction. The treatment that I give someone or that a doctor would give someone after they have a heart attack isn't going to bring back the dead tissue in their heart, but it will improve their quality of life, will improve the years of their life, and hopefully prevent complications, prevent another heart attack. Someone who has lung disease from smoking, we can't bring back the lung tissue that's been damaged, but giving someone medicine, giving them access to oxygen, all of these things, I mean, are not controversial at all. But when it comes to drugs, the logic or a reason kind of just go out the window for whatever reason.
Such a good point.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ryan, for your time. Really looking forward to you sharing all your knowledge, experience, expertise with our delegates tomorrow at the conference. I would highly recommend, if you're not already, to be following Ryan on social media. What is your handle again on?
So on Twitter or whatever it is now, yeah, I'm Ryan Marino, RyanMarino. That's the main one, yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, I would highly recommend a follow. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please like it, share it, and get in touch if you want to hear us covering anything else in the future. But for now, thanks very much. And yeah, we look forward to speaking to you next time.